encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome in, listeners, to another episode of the Perky Fledglings podcast. I'm your host, Colin Dams, joined once again by Nathan Heinschel and Polly Questel. And we're doing season review pod today. Boys, how are you feeling?
I'm so glad the season's over.
Dude, the schedule comes out tomorrow. I was like, you could have given us a longer break.
Oh my God.
I was like, the Champions League final was 4 days ago. Like, Jack Grealish's BAC has definitely not come back down to zero. We don't need to.
Do you think he's drunk at training right now for international duty?
I feel like it's a hair of the dog situation. Like, I feel like England's best hope is to just keep giving him booze. Like, be like, you'll sweat it out in the summer.
Let's be honest. I mean, England are playing like Malta and Macedonia this international break, so I don't know if Jack.
So they didn't need him anyway, and needed. Right, but like they called him in anyway, and.
Right, you know, he's got to start cleaning up at some point.
Yeah, time for Calvin Phillips to get a lot of minutes.
Yeah, he'll get his run in for the season. But yeah, we're doing season review today. I think it was Championship Sunday. The Premier League tweeted out something like, "Only 71 days until Premier League football returns." So it is very much similar vibes to last season of. I can't believe this season is finally over, but slightly different mood.
I was just going over the calendar with my wife. I was just going over the calendar with my wife a couple weeks ago, a couple days ago. And it was like, we were not that many weeks down the road where I was like, oh yeah, that's the United Arsenal game. So like busy that day. And she was like, already? I'm like, yeah, already.
I'm legitimately concerned that the Premier League season is going to start before I can finish Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom.
When does it? I guess it probably starts
like August 15th. I think is the weekend.
August 15th is a Tuesday, so you picked like one of the Jesus. A day smack dab where it can't be. Yeah, I'm gonna go with it. Probably starts August 11th. Is gonna be my guess.
Yeah, they're gonna have like Arsenal versus Brentford that day.
Yeah,
the vibes.
Yeah, is it Arsenal that always plays on the Friday before the season starts?
No, not always.
We did it once. We played Leicester.
I remember a couple years ago, like Liverpool just beating the absolute shit out of Norwich.
Yeah,
that happened. Yeah. Well, that was like because I think Norwich scored one or two, and they were still down by one at halftime, and we're like, oh, this might be like interesting. Norwich might be fun this season, and they got relegated.
Whereas, like Brentford against Arsenal, was it two seasons ago? Like that was amazing. That was a fun game to watch.
Right.
Yeah.
We're at the point, and this year was Arsenal and Crystal Palace, so that's why we always think it's Arsenal. We're at the point though where I went to the Premier League website today to like check something, and the default on this it was like there are no stats available, and I was like, what do you mean? And I looked, and, like, defaulted. Over. It defaulted to 23-24, and I was like, God, like it. The ink's not even dry yet.
Time to go to whoscored.com, bro.
I do think it is a little bit nice that the Women's World Cup starts in July rather than June when most international tournaments start, because we do actually get like at least a couple of weeks where it's just, I mean, I guess there's Nations League on this weekend, but there's really not a whole lot going on in general.
So like we get a few weeks to like really decompress.
Yeah, we get to like recalibrate.
As opposed to like normally when it's like you get the World Cup or the Euros and then you get to I think it's better because you get the when you have the World Cup or the Euros and then you get to mid-July and you're like, yes, club football's back. And then it's just really shit preseason matches. So now at least you'll get like women's World Cup matches where at least the stakes are high and it's like I can watch United. I could watch United if I want. But I could also watch a competitive match with high quality rather than being like, I'm going to watch Spurs versus PSG because it's on.
And they're playing like PSG is playing like eight players who are going to be sold to Juventus next summer or something.
Right, I love the there's two types of friendlies. I like the ones where the big teams wear shirts with no shirt numbers because it's like that low stakes of a game. And like, they're using that many youth players. And you don't get it with Premier League teams, but like you get it with like PSG and German teams is when they when they're out in the mountains on like a random park field in Austria or Switzerland. And it's like that's legitimately just like the municipal town field, and like there's a walking path with just people just walking by.
Yeah.
Hey, I do appreciate the simple things in life though, like overreacting to Zidane Iqbal playing a game in like Singapore
10 minutes against Liverpool. Like
against like an Australian Premier League team.
Well, you know. Get ready because guess what we're gonna do at MetLife Stadium.
This is also the perfect segue into what this episode is about, which is the season review of last season. And part one, which covers the summer until Brentford, titled, Well, 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 If It Isn't the Consequences of My Own Inaction. And part of that inaction saw many youngsters kind of come into the squad while they were in Australia and the Far East. And I guess, Nathan, do you want to lead us off talking a little bit about maybe the hype that was manufactured last summer by us and by other United fans in the wake of
I watched on MUTV as Rashford, Martial, and Sancho had one really good preseason game together, and I went positively feral. Like, I think maybe that's the craziest I've ever tweeted outside of, like, Jimmy Butler's most recent run in the NBA playoffs. Because obviously we're pretty big Martial heads over here. I think Colin, you and I both have Martial shirts. Like I'm very pro Martial, like at all times. And so I was really hoping that this was going to be like the every other year renaissance for Martial, especially with like, we're hoping for year two Sancho under a new manager, things are going to pop off. And, you know, I think we've always been, we were excited to see Rashford. I don't think we anticipated what the season Rashford was about to have going into the summer because of how bad last year was. And so it was kind of cool to see those three play somewhat well together in a, you know, relatively meaningless game. At least one of the three came good on that hype. So I guess maybe a 33% hit rate isn't bad if you're not talking about three projected starters. But
yeah, what I should have done was looked back through our Twitter from last July, because I'm pretty sure we wore out that one photo of the three of them celebrating a goal together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a quick turn of foot. Like, the vibes couldn't have been worse coming out of the season. And there was excitement around Erik ten Hag, but there was still hesitancy and maybe, dare I say, apathy towards the preseason. Like, we brought in Malacia fairly early. Lisandro Martinez dragged a little bit, but we got him in. We got him in pretty quick. And we're not... Lisandro Martinez didn't come to like after the preseason, right? As Maguire and Lindelof were like the two... Maguire and Lindelof started those games, and then Varane and Alex Tellez played as center backs. Yep. So, Lisandro Martinez was dragging.
No, we had Eriksen.
Right, so Christian Eriksen came, and it was like, all right, yeah, Christian Eriksen's a nice piece, but on a free transfer when we need at least two other midfielders, he's got to be the cherry on top. And at that time, and it was like, also, Christian Eriksen's an attacking midfielder. And then they go and they played a Liverpool side that had not barely done anything, and they played three different 11s over the 45 minutes. They played 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, and we won 4-0. Everybody rightfully lost their shit. It's always fun to beat Liverpool. And then we went and played a bunch of teams that we should have beaten, and we beat them, but it was fun. It was more fun than pretty much any game last season, bar Leeds on opening day, that we got hyped again. And I think there were people trying to say, like, watch out, but there was a lot of excitement because then after those games, Lisandro Martinez comes in. But then, yeah, you get hit quickly. I think the people were saying, all right, the right people were still saying, we're preaching hesitancy and saying, I don't know if, you know, this team still needs a lot of work. They've brought in three players. That's not enough. You can't play the way Erik ten Hag is going to want to play with the current team. And I think that's where the consequences of your own inaction comes in, because then the season starts. 3 days before the season starts, Anthony Martial gets hurt, and you're just like, well, shit, because the only striker we had, we just the entire preseason, we played with Martial up top. That's how we prepared. We didn't have Cristiano Ronaldo because he was trying to engineer a move away. He stayed away.
And he brought
down the vibes. What are we going to do against Brighton? And like, boom, the season hits you, and it hits you really quickly.
And I think it's worth mentioning, too, that Erik ten Hag was scheduling these extra like friendlies just to try and see, you know, what kind of squad he has outside of, you know, the people who were set to be the starters. And almost none of them played. I mean, Anthony Elanga started one or two games kind of early on in the season and then never really surfaced again unless he was a reserve player. Even Sancho, I mean, he had that period out of the team where he was working on himself and working on his, you know, his game with coaches over in the Netherlands. But like, Erik ten Hag got a look at a lot of players this season, and only a select few of them really stuck around throughout the year.
There's a lot of Jose Mourinho and Erik ten Hag, and the quote that's coming to mind right now is, I only need to look at a player for, what was it, 10 seconds, 10 minutes, whatever it was. I do remember in the preseason, he played Donny van de Beek deeper, and it was like, why are we doing that? You, of all people, should know where Donny van de Beek does his best work.
On the bench.
But, well, that's where he kept him. Yeah, he threw out some young guys, like Zidane Iqbal, like, looked like he belonged, but you're playing the tail end, like you're playing the tail end of a preseason friendly. You're not even starting. It's you're playing against the other teams, the Donic balls as well, that I think people get carried away in that. And in that, you have to remember with young players, the learning curve is steep, and looking good is different than being good. Like young players, in order to really make it, have to basically say, you can't drop me. And there was excitement to build around because he did look good, and it was like, we want to see these guys. But he was able to discern whether you're ready or not, whether you can help me or not. You don't do the things I'm looking for. And his actions throughout the season spoke volumes on that.
So I've been scrolling through our Twitter all the way back to July of 2022. And I just want to share this one that is, you know, perfect by Nathan.
I was going to say, let's play a game called Can You Guess If It Was Me or Colin That Tweeted It?
Where it was after they won that weird trophy that was like Tranquility Base Hotel and Casino vibes that I think had the little light up like gaming PC. And Nathan just had the when Alexander saw the breath of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Erik ten Hag looking totally unsatisfied and confused by whatever he was just handed.
Well, that was, we were coming off of the eras are meant to end quote or something like that too. So
yeah. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
That tweet is so good. Oh my God.
And you know, on the timeline as well, there's lots of Martial going on. We have the one, it's like a John Wick meme where people keep asking if I'm back. I haven't really had an answer. And then it shows John Wick and it just says Martial FC on his forehead. And he's like, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back. And then quickly to the end of July, you just tweeted a screen cap from the end of No Country for Old Men, RIP Cormac McCarthy. All the time you spend trying to get back, what's been took from you, more is going out the door. So the vibes as the season approached very quickly turned sour. Cristiano Ronaldo kind of coming back into the fold. And then, of course, we have the two opening games of the Premier League season. The 2-1 loss at home against Brighton. I think it was like 2 days before that game that Martial injury news broke out. And then the next week,
I think it was Friday and the Brentford game was Sunday.
Yeah, and of course, Cristiano Ronaldo starting in that game against Brentford and really just kind of leaving a kind of a helpless feeling that was eventually remedied by the arrival of Casemiro. But I don't even want to say that it was remedied by Casemiro at the time, because it still felt pretty helpless, because it just seemed like there were so many holes to patch that one person wasn't going to be able to do too much of about it.
Yeah, I'm gonna call those first two games were the agenda affirming games of whatever your agenda was, you could point to those two games and put the blame on someone. If you didn't like Ten Hag for whatever reason, you could be like, dude, his tactics were atrocious given the players he had and how he didn't make any adjustments over those two games and got destroyed. If you didn't like Harry Maguire, you can point the finger at him and blame him for some of the things that happened. If you don't like Scott McTominay, you can look at that first goal against Brighton and be like, that set the tone and he was terrible. If you didn't like David De Gea, you can point the finger at him in a lot of areas. If you didn't like Cristiano Ronaldo, you could point the finger at him. Whatever your agenda was, those two games had it. The reality was those games were not, those games have taken on a bit of a difference to what actually happened, where people say, well, they tried to play a high line and they failed. They didn't. Their line was not that high in either game. They played much higher lines later in the season. They were trying to play out of the back and they failed at that miserably. No argument there. The numbers, like their expected goals against Brighton, 1.5. They United themselves 1.4. Like, that's not that bad. There's definitely an element of Brighton took their foot off the gas in the second half and just were content to let United do whatever because United weren't threatening. Brentford 1.6. They scored 4 goals on that. One of, like, the Brentford match was more quick sudden shock than a thorough beatdown. They weren't particularly overwhelmed. The first goal came 9 minutes in when David De Gea practically threw the ball into his own net. The second goal is a tactical breakdown. Christian Eriksen, there's a man sitting right on him, and David De Gea passed him the ball anyway. Guess what? He lost it. Boom, it's in the back of your net. Third goal is a set piece. De Gea rooted to his line. It's a corner. They concede. Fourth goal, they concede off their own corner, which is something that has been a theme for years now, and it wasn't the last time that happened this season. And suddenly it's 4-0 at halftime, and your striker is Ronaldo, who's not doing anything threatening, and it just turned bleak right away.
And it was also clear when Ronaldo was playing that he was not fit because he wasn't available throughout the summer. I mean, he played like 10 minutes against Southampton and he looked totally gassed by the end of those 10 minutes. Sorry, that's getting a little bit further ahead.
I mean, but that schedule, yeah, that's but, part yeah. of it. It's Martial was hurt. Martial got hurt, so like in terms of there was no, you didn't have an Antony to come in. So who's playing there? Like he goes with Christian Eriksen as like a false nine rather than move Rashford over, and you didn't really have another winger. You had Sancho in there, and Bruno on the right wasn't a thing yet. Like there genuinely wasn't anything to do, and so it was like, all right, I guess I have to play. You know, and then in game two, when McTominay was hurt, it's like, I got to play Fred and Eriksen, which was a pair that you look at that from the start and you're like, that's never going to work as a pair. Like you played Christian Eriksen as a deep line playmaker against the team he played for last season. Who knew? He can't do that. And your only other option up front is Ronaldo, who was very off of it. It just, like, that's the consequence of your own inaction. As you went into the season, the team had so many holes, and you went and signed a backup left back and an attacking midfielder put in midfield and a center back. You're not ready for the season, and that's how you started. And no wonder you get a wake up call.
And so, over the next few days is when the Casemiro news really takes off. And actually, you know, for Man United transfers of that scale, you don't see this a whole lot where the news emerges and within a few days it's basically done. His first day in Manchester is their next game. He arrives just in time to see Man United face Liverpool. And that's when we get the starting 11 that we see pretty much for the next month or so. And that's when the next part of our season review sectioning called "This is better, but Casemiro better fix this." So that starting 11 was Diogo Dalot on the right, Malassi on the left, Varane and Martinez as the center back pairing, McTominay and Eriksen midfield pivot, Bruno Fernandes 10, Sancho on the right, Elanga on the left, Rashford up top. Obviously, Elanga, I think, either got hurt or this was the game where he just, you know, kind of dropped off after a little bit. And it would end up being, once Antony got there, Antony on the right, Sancho on the left, Rashford up top. Some variation of that front three. And it worked. Kind of from the start, United looked really motivated to beat Liverpool. They got an early goal through Sancho. And then in the second half, they got a counterattacking goal. But of course, between that and after that, there was a lot of Liverpool possession, some scary moments. They did get a goal sort of just before the end. But this was a Liverpool team that was also starting to figure out some of the problems that it had. And particularly when it came to scoring goals. Defensively, they were a little bit of a mess. Their midfield was starting to wear out. And of course, they'd played something like over 60 games the season before, and they didn't change a whole lot. And I believe Luis Diaz may have gone down injured in this game as well and would miss the next 6 months. So a little bit of a combination of United bouncing back and playing an opponent that maybe wasn't totally figured out themselves, but a really, really important win for Erik ten Hag early in his Manchester United tenure.
Yeah, this was the most Mourinho game we've had. We sat as deep as possible in our box defending for dear life. This was a game where effort can make up and overcome a talent gap. You see a lot of times where one team just blows out the other team and fans immediately are just like, oh, they didn't care. It's disgrace. There's no effort. Because there's this general belief that when you come up against a better team, effort, work rate, getting stuck in can overcome that. And sometimes it does, but most of the time, like, talent wins out, and talent will use that effort against you, drag you out of position, pass around you, and make it look like you're not actually putting in the effort. This was a game where the effort really closed that gap, because even before United went 1-0 up, and they went 1-0 up like 13 minutes in, it's pretty quick. But even before that, you just saw it and you were like, the technical level of like of the 11 Liverpool players is higher than the technical level of the 11 United players. Every one of them is comfortable with the ball at their feet. You can't say that about United. But they got stuck in. They got their two goals. They defended for dear life. They got their win. It's a big win. It's always big to beat Liverpool, no matter what. And they took that. And they just ground out results for the next few matches. But they were very shaky ground. They went to Southampton a week later, and they created two scoring chances all game. And Southampton created a bunch more, didn't finish. United get the 1-0 win because they did finish one of their two. They went to Leicester, where they really did nothing and left the door wide open for Leicester, who also just didn't do anything because Leicester are crap. And then they come back against Arsenal, where they can do that, what they did to Liverpool again. They can sit back, hit you on the counterattack. They do get a break early in the match when Arsenal take a 1-0 lead and VAR takes that goal off the board, which the Premier League a few months later would say that was a mistake. That goal should have stood, which probably changes the game state a bit. But they are able to, they get a big goal early. They get a Rashford counterattack right after Arsenal equalize, and they get a big win. And then they go to the Europa League, where they're now able to like start getting some players involved and everything. Like, because Casemiro did show up. I think people forget how bad he was in some of the, like, he made his debut against Southampton.
The trend was he would come on and he would lose the ball.
Like, yeah, he was awful.
During that Arsenal match, in the last 10 minutes or so, he gave the ball away around midfield while receiving it, and Harry Maguire had to make a yellow card tackle just to stop Arsenal from having a goal scoring opportunity. And everyone, of course, you know, pointed to Harry Maguire on Twitter but like Casemiro kind of started a trend of putting his defenders in bad situations. Something we also see, I mean, really, it was the case in the Liverpool game just because of the pure approach of it. But Erik ten Hag trying to find ways to bypass the midfield, kind of realizing what he was working with even before Casemiro came in. And when Casemiro does come in later, we see a little bit of this, too, of just like, how do we quickly find Bruno Fernandes? Like, how do we quickly find somebody who is careful at or who we can trust to carry the ball with his feet forward, because Christian Eriksen wasn't really doing that. Receiving the ball deeper was not really inspiring confidence in Christian Eriksen's early performances. But that Arsenal match, I think, really kind of changed the narrative around him a little bit, to a point that was pretty inaccurate, but of kind of viewing Christian Eriksen as a really safe kind of deeper midfielder, which, you know, wasn't the case, but a showcase of what Eriksen can do when he receives and quickly distributes the ball further up the pitch.
Yeah. And I do. Yeah. Like, Casemiro was bad in these games, and he came on. He got his first start in the Europa League, which they lost to Real Sociedad. Terrible penalty, but also sort of like a make your own luck situation. Like, United played that corner terribly, backed everybody into their own box, and basically said they invited bad things to happen in that game. They didn't score a goal at home, where they've been so good this year. A lot of that was Ronaldo. There were a lot of situations in that game where you could see what he was thinking and doing, and his body just couldn't keep up with that. And you were like, not even in prime Ronaldo, but like 2 years ago, last year, Ronaldo, that's a goal. And now it's not happening. And Casemiro he wasn't anything special in that game, which is what kept McTominay. Like, I remember thinking back months later and looking at that first derby where they lost 6-3 and being like, Eric Ten Hag legitimately picked Scott McTominay over Casemiro in this game by choice. And part of that was because he was waiting for McTominay to lose the spot. It was sort of like, these are my guys. They won against Liverpool. They won against Arsenal. That spot's yours until you get it. And also because nobody was really knocking on the door to be like, you need to put me in there instead of him. And this was the period of the season where people were saying McTominay is playing amazing and he's revived, and he's reached much higher levels under Eric Ten Hag, which happens every with every manager. They said the same thing about McTominay under Solskjaer. They said it under Ralf Rangnick when he first came in. The reality was that Ten Hag basically said, get out of the way. We're not passing the ball to him. He touched the ball. United attempted about 20 passes less to McTominay than to any of their other midfielders. It was just like, get out of the way. So he was good because he wasn't making mistakes. But that kept him in the team because Casemiro wasn't knocking him out of the team. And then you go to the Etihad and Pep looks at that team and goes, right, your midfield's Eriksen and McTominay. I'm going to pick on them all game and expose them. And he did that very quickly.
Yeah. Not the best memory for United of this season. I think there would be a worse result later, but 6-3. Probably the best week, though, of the season for my fantasy Premier League team, which had both Phil Foden and Erling.
Well, aren't you lucky?
Yeah.
But yeah, the other thing is Antony comes into the team, very smart player in that he scores on his debut and scores against City. So, it buys you a lot of time
big,
in case you're
big
not
big game
gonna,
player label early on.
Right. Very smart to score on your debut. That's going to buy you a lot of time. But I do remember like texting you guys that Antony has done absolutely nothing. Antony's done absolutely nothing today. And then as soon as I hit send on that text, he like puts the ball on his left foot from 40 yards away and blasts it in the top corner. And I was like, well, now at least they're going to say he scored a goal as he did nothing.
Yeah.
And then Colin and I are texting you, text us again.
Yeah, send this six more times. And Martial also having like the real stat booster game there, because for a little while this season we were like, oh, his goals per minute ratio is actually really, really good. And part of that is because he came on with ten minutes left and scored a penalty, and
we scored twice and he scored
another
himself.
Goal. Yeah. So before he was promptly injured again. And I think he actually played a Europa League game where he linked up with Rashford, and we got some more good vibes from that. But
he did. I think he started the next Europa League game.
Yeah,
like with Ronaldo.
This is the last Premier League game of the McTominay Eriksen pivot, I believe. Casemiro comes in against Everton,
Not the last one for now. It would come.
Yeah, back. Until emergency break glass in case of emergency. They would win against Everton 2-1. Two Ammonia fixtures in the Europa League that are pretty funny but unmemorable, mostly because Cristiano Ronaldo could not score a goal to save his life, including in situations where he was right in front of the goal. But yeah, we got a nice Martial Rashford performance somewhere in there. 0-0 against Newcastle, and then 2-0 win over Tottenham at Old Trafford, which seemed like it was where the vibe started to pick back up a little bit again. The Newcastle game was boring, and the United Everton game was a little bit nervy because they got caught into more of a game than they should have been against Frank Lampard's Everton. But United against Tottenham was maybe the first of them where we're like, we should be scoring four goals in this one, and they just couldn't, because this isn't a team that scores four goals until May. But
was one of the best games they played all year.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this, all right, you forgot to introduce this part. It's the next part of the season, which is this Everton match until the World Cup, where it was, they got going on a roll. Casemiro comes into the team, they get going on a roll. And I would say, they were good in the Europa League. They won five games, though one of those games kind of a loss. But I think that the good Europa League form, which because of the calendar was every week. They were basically playing every other week. There wasn't the breakup that we usually get in September, October, November, because there's no international breaks. It sort of distracted from, it gave the impression that United were doing better than they were. They in that time period, they won nine games, they drew two. They had one loss in the league, four wins, two draws, one loss. So, four wins out of seven. That's not particularly great. It's good. It's not great. They moved from sixth in the table to fifth. So they never won two in a row. But because they kept going in the Europa League, it seemed like we're on this onwards and upwards trajectory. But yeah, the warning signs were kind of there because you did have these Europa League games that you should have been dominating and putting teams away in, and you weren't. You had a game against Ammonia where at home, where you beat the worst team in the group one goal on a Scott McTominay 94th minute winner. Like, why did it take 94 minutes to score against Ammonia?
Yeah, you also
that
get
should have been a warning sign.
I mean, they had to mount a comeback in the League Cup against Aston Villa to win 4-2, who an Aston Villa team that they'd lost to at Villa Park, I think earlier that week.
I think they won the first one.
No, they lost 3-1 to Villa. That was Unai Emery's first game. That was when Luke Shaw scored on that weird deflection.
I think they played twice consecutively, once in the League Cup and once in the
Premier League.
I think the League Cup came first.
I'm looking at the schedule right now.
Okay, so then you're so then I'm wrong.
Yeah,
you're right. They did well. Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. So yeah,
I was just trying to make the point that that game, there was also a 1-0 over West Ham where Rashford scores a centurion goal, but otherwise they do very little. And then you also have the Fulham match right before the World Cup where Garnacho has to score that last minute. Kind of like, how did he run onto the end of that pass goal? And that's three results where if they went the other way, or if they were just draws, we would be talking about this season very differently, potentially, just because of the points lost there. But kind of saving results from the disappointment that seemed to be building up over most of the 90 minutes of those matches.
Yeah, and let's not forget, it starts that 1-0 against West Ham where they did not create a lot, which you can argue, and I'd say it's a fair argument that part of the reason that they did not create a lot was because Ronaldo was starting as the striker, and he just doesn't. Antony's not the kind of winger that's going to work well with even if you took Juventus Ronaldo. Antony's not the kind of winger that's going to work well with that kind of player. Rashford's not the kind of winger that's going to work well with that kind of player. It does hamstring you, but 90th minute, Bruno Fernandes picks up a yellow card in what was like your, it's your 14th game of the season, and he's already got his fifth yellow card, and now he's suspended. And that leads to Erik ten Hag in the game against Real Sociedad, where you need to win by 2 goals in order to win the group. You know this going in, and you need to do that because you could not score against Real Sociedad at home. You could not score more than 1 goal against Ammonia at home. You need to... Erik ten Hag's got to balance that with also, I have to get ready for Bruno Fernandes to not be in the team against Aston Villa next week. I think that's the first time Fernandes starts on the right wing. And Donny van de Beek comes in and plays as the number 10 behind Ronaldo, which essentially is playing with 10 men. Not 10 men, 9 men. Because van de Beek's not involved on the ball. Off the ball, he's like a glorified parking cone. He's a mobile traffic cone in that he moves around, but you just run right by him. You go right around him. And United, they scored right. They scored like 10 minutes into the game. But at the end of the day, they only managed 4 shots to win 1-0 in a game they needed to win by 2, summed up by the fact that in the last 5-10 minutes, whatever it was, Harry Maguire comes on to play striker.
Which maybe should have been done more, you know, considering United striker options. But yeah, kind of, I mean, looking ahead to the rest of the season and what that meant, obviously adding in a 2-legged fixture against Barcelona in a part of the season where United's players were starting to drop off for whatever reason, in hindsight, is not great. I will say, though.
So it leads to the biggest win of the season.
Yeah. It was fun.
Probably big win 1A, I would say. But also might have killed your season because
It's
2 games that just in a part of the season when everybody's already hurt, that those break you down exponentially. You know, you wear down, the more tired you are, the faster the wear down is. And that's a huge blow to only come away 1-0. And then you go to Villa where now you're missing Bruno Fernandes and the team does nothing. And yeah, those are some scary signs. So like everything seems to be going well. You've advanced in the League Cup. You've got a lot of wins. You've advanced in the Europa League. They do turn it around against Fulham. They get they go on to the World Cup in like on a high because Garnacho, academy kid, 18-year-old, scores this goal. I think it was an injury time. If not, it was like 89th minute. The biggest high you could have. So you go into the World Cup feeling great.
And you also get rid of Cristiano Ronaldo.
And Ronaldo does his interview. So you know he's gone. I remember looking at the end of the World Cup when I was like trying to get back into club football, and it was just like, oh right, I forgot this team is like very average. And that their numbers are very not good, and this team needs to get a lot better in the second half of the season, otherwise they're in trouble.
Yeah. I do want to bring up too, before we move on to like the post World Cup section, and Nathan, we'll get you into the conversation on this, I guess, but Marcus Rashford kind of getting goals spaced out between games at this point, in the Europa League, he's, you know, really important, especially in those games where United were underperforming and Ronaldo couldn't turn the ball into a goal to save his life. But it seems like this was kind of the section of the season where United were developing a dependency on him to be their source of goals.
Oh, is this where you wanted to get me in the conversation?
Yes. Nathan, talk now.
Yeah. And it was weird watching the World Cup because I think we were expecting him to have the opportunity to contribute more, which has led to more conversations post, wondering if Harry Kane was going to come here and whether or not they'd actually link up and work well together. And it's like, well, I mean, they play together in England and that really hasn't been the case. And then he just kind of like came out of a cannon. It felt like post World Cup, like it just scorched earth. And it was like, well, maybe England should have taken advantage of that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, whenever he played at the World Cup, he was clearly confident. He was taking his chances early, and he kind of similar to the goal he scored against Burnley, the way that he just kind of decided to run through Iran at one point and then score a goal. He even came on late against France in that quarterfinal game. He almost scored on a free kick, but he looked really, really good. Which
the France game is team card too. The France game. First of all, as again, love the backward ass thinking of United fans who just sit there and complain. It's the World Cup, and it's the middle of the season. Our players are going to go. They're going to get hurt, and then complain that Marcus Rashford isn't playing as much. If Marcus Rashford plays more in the World Cup, we probably get him for a lot fewer games afterwards. I think part of the reason that he exploded right after the World Cup was because he stayed in match shape. He played at the World Cup. He trained every day like he was going to play, but he didn't play that many minutes. And so he comes back not tired, but also with a bit of a chip on his shoulder and a point to prove, and gets a very soft schedule to run at. The France game is the one game. I think fans lose. The France game is the one game where he should have played more. I think fans lose track of how football works and how international managers want construct their squads and everything, and they fall into the trap very quickly of,
why is this a good player playing?
Yeah, this player scores goals. Why isn't he in there? This player does this player A is better than player B. Why is player B the starter? And it's like, well, Gareth Southgate's looking at him going, I've got Harry Kane as my goal scorer guy, who also doesn't do a lot of defending. So I'm on my wings. I need guys that are going to give him, that are going to supply him, but also cover his defensive thing. And it's like Marcus Rashford's, what he brings to the table is also goals, but not a lot of defending. So it's like, do I need both? I don't need both of them in there at the same time, because Kane's already taking that responsibility. So maybe you say Rashford is better than that winger, but Southgate says Harry Kane is better than Rashford. Therefore he gets the spot. I need somebody else there. But when you're playing France and you're down, he should have come on with more than 6 minutes to go, because at that point, who gives a shit if you give up a third goal or a fourth goal, because you need to score in order to stay alive. But yeah, then they come back, and that's where Rashford takes off. And again, one of those things where, like, then you get to form the narrative, where when you don't like certain things, you throw in all the caveats of, okay, look at who they're playing. They are playing, and
they played
cup games against a lot of bad teams. And when you do like what's going on, you just throw it in and say, United have won 9 in a row.
Yeah, so they play, they come out of the World Cup and they play a team that was relegated the year before in Burnley. They play a team that was almost relegated this year in Nottingham Forest, a team that was almost relegated in Wolves, a team that was almost relegated in Bournemouth, and a team that was almost relegated in Everton. Then they play a League One side in Charlton, and then they play Manchester City, which you could argue...
Champions of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not going to talk about that.
But all right, how many games was that? How many games did you just rattle off?
Yeah, that's 7 games where they...
One of them. Only one of them. Was away against. From Old Trafford.
Yeah.
6 yes. Home games. Where and that's
no, the entire and, cup draw for both League Cup and FA Cup was at Old Trafford.
The League Cup the cup draws were the most friendly thing United have ever gotten. Because United for the previous 3-4 years were getting awful cup draws, while City got to play, like, if there was a non-league side somewhere, City got to play them. And somehow United got the City draw of every they played only bottom half Premier League teams and lower division teams every game at home. In the League Cup, they didn't play a top half side until Newcastle in the final. In the FA Cup, they didn't play a top half side, or they didn't play a top four side or anything until Brighton in the semifinals. Brighton were on a top four side, and then City in the final. Like we've said this on the show of. Every single game they were the favorite, and every single game they won until the final, where they were not the favorite and they did not win. But when you look back at the season and you look back and you go, oh, you know, they were kind of a different home side. You put things into perspective of how certain players performed, how the team performed. Like, this is where Rashford made a name for himself. And it's like, yeah, well, all the games were at home. And Marcus Rashford this year was a different player at home than he was away from home. Now, granted, the one away game that they played in this stretch, Marcus Rashford scored the lone goal and had a second goal questionably taken off the board.
Yeah, I would say even in the next section we're going to talk about, I mean, he's got a really good away performance against Barcelona, and then he scores that incredible goal against Arsenal that, you know, wasn't really a game that gave him the ball that much. But yeah, I mean, like Nathan said, it was like he shot out of a cannon, and this was really where the kind of national attention on Marcus Rashford was reinvigorated, probably for the first time in maybe over two seasons.
If you want to scroll through our tweets again, I'm sure there's probably some Ballon d'Or talk in there at some point.
Yeah, so you quote tweet the Short Fuse when they said, is there anybody in the Premier League having a better season than Martin Odegaard? And you, that's when Marcus Rashford also started doing this celebration, which I hit in my Sunday league, by the way, when I scored one
for,
of my
for the audio listeners goals. Of the podcast, which is everyone, it's when he points to his
Collins,
forehead.
Yeah. Collins doing the celebration in Sunday league, the influence of Marcus Rashford, maybe.
Yeah,
I know.
It was from outside the box, too, just so
I mean, who's more influenced by Marcus Rashford, though, this year?
Anyone who has ever pointed at their head is influenced by Marcus Rashford.
That's not what Nathan's talking about.
Sorry, say it again.
Colin, did you name anybody Marcus this year?
Yeah. Huh? Colin, did you recently have a child named Marcus?
No, I do have a cat named Bruno.
I mean, that's pretty sick, though.
Yeah.
His question was, who did Marcus Rashford influence the most? I think I won that one.
Yeah.
That not Will Smith's character from Bad Boys?
Maybe.
You
either
just
way.
Make a list of Marcus.
No, my bad.
This was a fun was time Lally. Of the year.
Yes,
helps you forget. Helps you forget that it's January and it gets dark out at 5 o'clock and it's cold. And the World Cup's over because United went 7-0, and they culminated that with a win against Manchester City with Marcus Rashford scoring the winner. So big thing, but it would quickly get dire when they then started having to play midweek Premier League games rather than midweek cup games.
Well, Paulie's really playing hosting duties here, trying to get us back on topic. But I do want to point out that Manchester Derby was approximately 8 hours after my appendix had been removed.
Oh, right. Colin playing hurt for that game.
Yeah.
Forgot about that. Heroic performance.
I slept a total of an hour and a half that night because they told me you have to walk to keep the blood moving through your legs. So I had to get up a couple times in the night and walk around the hospital. And then
also led to probably your best tweet of the year.
Did he tweet it, though?
I didn't actually tweet it. I never tweeted. Oh.
No, that's for the Patreon. Sign up for the Patreon and then you can see what would have been Colin's funniest tweet of the year.
Create an OnlyFans and our listeners can pay to see what that tweet would have been.
It's still saved in my drafts, so
it should be.
I could just fire it
We can't describe it because then they won't have a reason to OnlyFans it. Like, but trust me, it's worth it. And there is no nudity. Don't worry.
If you're still listening to the pod at this point,
it is rated PG.
Yeah.
Tweet at the Busby Babe account, which is not affiliated to the Fergie Fledglings podcast. Just say post
release
tweet
the Colin photo. Yeah. But yeah. So now we are going to move along to the next section of the season, which is titled. So this was from Crystal Palace to the Beverage Cup final. Quote, we're in the title race. Kind of ironic because that game against Crystal Palace was kind of the beginning of the humbling of Manchester
United.
That was
the sentiment. Cup. That was certainly the sentiment after the derby.
Oh, yeah.
I think we're 5 points off the
Peter Drury, who, by the way, had some excellent moments this season. I think number one might still be Rashford's goal against Liverpool, where he just like. He does that commentator thing where he like gets the people he's with to not say anything and just like lets the moment happen. And it's the loudest we've heard Old Trafford in a long time. And he says Manchester United are living again. He has another one against after the Man City game where it's something like Erik ten Hag has this club back where they belong, or something like along those lines of like, this feels like Manchester United again. And well, then,
sure, but it felt good.
Yeah, but like Peter, you know, Peter Drury is one, he's a commentator. It's like he is a poet of the moment, and that's really what it felt like against, you know, pulling off that kind of win against Manchester City, who were still very much ahead of us in the title race and the league table at the time. And then
we're like 5 points ahead.
Yeah. Well, then we draw against Crystal Palace.
The humbling would come, though. The humbling would come. We were 8 days away.
Have we not given up that free kick at Selhurst Park, you know?
Yeah.
But then the humbling came before that.
It wasn't just that. Like Michael Olise hits that banger, like you said, Nathan, and Casemiro gets suspended from the Arsenal match, which we all know is the real, like, if we want to be in the title race, we have to win these three matches. Yep. And that's
and then we
where
had to lose to the true villain, which was the short fuse's tweets.
they start out the Crystal Palace match very well. Like Bruno scores like 8 minutes in, and it comes off of a run that Wout Weghorst makes to occupy the center backs and open up that space. And I very much remember
that was Weghorst's first game, wasn't it?
Weghorst's first game, and I very much remember everybody rationally being like, Martial's never going to see the field again, being like, finally, we have a striker
look
who makes
the work
runs,
rate
and that's
on this guy.
What happens. That's what happens when you have a striker that makes movement. Runs. And guess what? Like, they didn't create shit the rest of the game. And they did not, they never put Crystal Palace away, and they did this so many times this year, and it didn't matter. But the risk you take is, well, what happens if the ball takes a bad bounce or there's just a moment of magic? And that's what happens is Mike Olise hits just a banger of a free kick. I'm like, yeah, the referee spotted the ball incorrectly. And all these little things happen in the match that never should have happened because you should have put Crystal Palace away earlier. And on top of that, Casemiro gets a yellow card and he's suspended for the Arsenal match.
Right. Sorry, I was scrolling through my drafts trying to look for the tweet. So this Arsenal match too, I mean, we lose 3-2. There's that really, really good Rashford goal where he picks it off Thomas Partey, just like spins him around and then fires it in from 30 yards out or so. But other than that, it's a game where Arsenal really just outclass United. And to be fair, this is the peak of Arsenal's form where everyone is like, oh, they actually look like they can pull this off. They're really riding high on confidence. And they've got Odegaard and Bukayo Saka are both like playing out of their minds. Saka scores an equally incredible goal in this match, as you know, on top of, I think it wasn't Reece Nelson who scored the winner, was it?
I think it was
Eddie Nketiah.
Yeah.
But just like a, you know, even without Gabriel Jesus, they can plug in their other striker, and this is just a fully functioning machine. And Manchester United are just not there yet.
Yeah, this was a process versus result match. If you looked at the result, you would think, and there are plenty of people that did. You would think that United were right there, and they went up with Arsenal, and it was a late winner, and they're ready to fight with the big boys. And then you would be surprised at the subsequent results that happened in the second half of the season. If you looked at the process, all the other things that they're doing and what caused everything, you would be like, this game was never close, and that United have a long way to go, and there's a lot of warning signs. The first half, Rashford, he scores a spectacular goal, pulls it out of nothing, as against the run of play as you come. Like, it was probably like the 16 minutes in the game, but it was like the first time United even touched the ball in the attacking third. The first half was one of the worst halves Arsenal played, and that might be because Arsenal were bad, and it might be credit to United. It sort of looked like the FA Cup semifinal against Brighton, where like United were more, we're not going to let you do things. But the flip side was United didn't do anything. Colin's still looking through his phone for that tweet, so it feels like I'm talking to nobody. and then in the second half, Arsenal make adjustments and United never adjust to. And again, they pull a goal out of their ass. Lisandro Martinez scores on a corner. How many times are you going to rely on that happening all season? That's something that happens once in a season. It comes up in a big spot, which helps you possibly nick a result. But Arsenal were just so good. They blew them away. And like Colin said, Saka scores this great goal. And Nketiah scores the other goal. If it weren't those goals, they should have scored on other occasions. De Gea did make some great saves. A well-deserved win for Arsenal that the scoreline makes it look closer. It was the only game. Casemiro not being there hurt. Part of the issue on the last goal was that Arsenal were patient and just dragged United's midfield out of position. And they took a risk to try to win the ball back. They missed it. And that created a mismatch, and boom, they scored a goal. So then United come back to play Crystal Palace.
They have the two legs against
Nottingham Forest.
Yeah, and then the Reading, and then
which Nottingham Forest they blow away. Reading, they also blow away, but they lose Christian Eriksen.
Yes, and it's kind of this panic. There's only 2 days left in the window. They're able to bring in Marcel Sabitzer on loan, and we're like, okay, this could work out.
Nottingham Forest at the time were 19th in the table, and then Reading are a championship side. You get those two wins, and everybody's just like, oh, we're back on track. And it was like, beating Nottingham Forest and Reading is not the same as playing against Arsenal.
And part of this winning run, it's not just Rashford's goals, but it's really this realization of, like, Casemiro is way better than most midfielders on the planet, including against these very, you know, average to below average Premier League and Championship sides that we're just plowing through. And that Reading game, I think he scores two goals where one of them is just like, a perfect example of the kind of instincts that he has in the area of the pitch that he dominates, which is kind of at the base of United's possession, monitoring where possession is and at what point he can kind of go forward and contribute. And then he just hits like another banger from like 30 yards out that goes through a crowd. And then against Crystal Palace, he gets sent off in a VAR incident that is very frustrating, to say the least. This was the hands on the neck one.
The hands on the neck. That's a red card. The frustrating part is that Crystal Palace did the same thing. And it's like, why did the VAR only look at Casemiro and not at, I think it was Jordan Ayew?
It's like literally everyone else who is touching each other in the same shot.
Yeah, it's this scenario, like during this run where you talk about how good Casemiro is, it's even more evident, not just in the games that he's not playing, but whenever Casemiro missed a tackle, the opposing team either scored or got their best scoring chance of the game. Like almost every time he missed, he went up for a header and he missed, or he missed a tackle. It didn't happen a lot. It speaks to how good he is. But that's how important he is that if he doesn't clean up, team's in trouble. And so he gets that red card, which I think another misconception here is like how much Rashford, like this team in that run, Rashford scored a lot of late goals where the team like scored one goal and then later in the game, they just picked teams off on the counter. And Rashford would like get his cut. There were some games where Rashford was like, oh, there he is in the 89th minute. Of course he's scoring a goal. Like you can't keep him off the board.
Or like they thought that they could win it without him. And they're like, oh, we're only up 1-0 and he'd come on with 10 minutes left.
Yes. But yeah, then Casemiro picks up this red card and he's going to be suspended for 3 games. And you're looking around being like, well, we did bring in Marcel Sabitzer, but he doesn't fit with anybody that's not Casemiro, and neither does McTominay, and neither does Fred.
And nobody does what Casemiro does.
Right.
Like a poor level.
It quickly becomes apparent against Leeds. Leeds were bad, and you should have rolled over Leeds at home, and suddenly they're down 2-0, and they're not really getting anything, and it's kind of a stroke of luck that Ten Hag just rolls the dice and he goes, Sancho, you've been out of the team for months, but that I think this was like Sancho's third appearance since the World Cup and maybe his first in the league. And Facundo Pellistri, who I believe was making his Premier League debut, he just puts them out there and goes, well, it's 2-0. Why not? And they get us back into it. You know, that's where
was this Sancho picture goal. That game?
Yeah, where he is doing the rashy and he's like yelling. Well, Nathan, I'm pretty sure you had an XV tweet on that one.
Oh, the X vibes. I mean, they were unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, as members of the Jadon Sancho.
Oh, we're not
to Man United club. Sancho. Yeah, I think we have more mixed feelings on it now than we did at the beginning of the season. But like, if there was ever a time where you were like, oh, it's time, we need something to make us believe in Jadon Sancho again, it's probably these couple games here where, I mean, he has a good one against Barcelona too, but he scores against Leeds and then he has that great game against Leicester City in the second half where I guess maybe he just wasn't in the first half, or maybe he was subbed on. I'm not sure, but sorry. Okay. Continue, Paulie.
Against the West. Yeah. Oh, you know, I know which one you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. He was
go to Elland Road.
He was subbed.
They
on
go to Elland Road, half. And it's more of the same, but this time they don't concede the two goals, and it was finally like Ten Hag went, you know what, Rashford on the left. Leeds are just taking him out of the game here. I'm just going to put Rashford up top. He goes with the Weghorst as a 10 thing. For the first time, they score two goals. Not so much because of Weghorst as a 10. He's really a placeholder. It's more because of Garnacho and Rashford being central strikers. And then they follow that up, I believe, by going then they go to Barcelona, have that game where Rashford does play very well. The entire second half, they were just being like, hey, Rashford, you stay up top. We're just going to hoof the ball deep and you're going to chase it. And why not? Barcelona were asking them to do that. Rashford's doing it and he was doing it really well. They really should have won that game. That was a 2-2 draw, which was a good result because of everything, but also felt like a terrible result. And then they come home and play Leicester. And this is the game you're talking about. They started with Weghorst as the 10.
Yeah, they looked awful in the first half.
Rashford ran in behind. Bruno made the pass to him, and he scored. And other than that, it ultimately ended up being the second worst first half of the season, not counting Brentford. It was probably the worst. It was the worst first half they had played in quite some time. And Ten Hag does change it at halftime, and Leicester were picking on Garnacho. They were so bad they couldn't take advantage of it. At halftime, he brings on Sancho, and they play like the best second half they've played all season. Certainly the best half of football that they've played since the Spurs match.
I think arguably the best goal that they've scored all season in terms of just like a team goal was that Jadon Sancho goal, where you have this interplay of Jadon Sancho kind of coming in from the left and finding Bruno, making a run back center to receive the final pass and then tap it in. And, you know, this is a bad Leicester City team. Like, going into the season, we didn't think that they would be this bad. But this is a bad Leicester City team that deserved to be relegated.
And they played the last 10 minutes being like, as if Wout Weghorst was a make-a-wish kid who wished that he could score a goal at Old Trafford. And all they were doing was giving him the ball.
Yeah. But, kind of a necessary stabilizing of United going into, you know, what at the time felt like two games that could make or break the season, which was Barcelona on the return leg and then Newcastle in the League Cup final.
Yeah, and they beat Barcelona, a bad Barcelona team who were missing like their two best midfielders. Like, and Gavi and Pedri, I think, were both out.
Yep.
No, we beat the champions of Spain, Pauly.
Yeah, well, yes.
Yeah, the champions of Spain who could not win in Europe, who had fallen out of the Champions League. And Spain, they do get the 1-0 lead. And United come back and win 2-1.
I just want to say, that's a director of communications right there. He knows how to spin those results.
Yeah. it overall, it wasn't the best performance, but it's knockout football. It's about winning. and they go to the Beverage Cup final, where again they are the second best team on the field. They are, but they get the two goals in about 6 minutes. They strike twice, and as Casemiro said, cup finals aren't for performing, they're for winning. And I remember everybody reacting to this as like, this is the new dawn. This is what it is. This is, we're back.
Damn, it's like Colin wrote an entire article.
I think this
I'm gonna look up exactly what I said.
The tough part is the fact that it's in February, it was like March 1st. Is that when you have a team like this, where you're trying to get back in, but also win a trophy, you haven't won a trophy in 6 years. If you do it in the League Cup, it's very hard to come back off that elation that you just got. That you just had. Like, it's very hard to then go, like, imagine if you didn't win the League Cup, but you won the FA Cup, and you just take that into the summer, celebrate, boom, rubber stamps the season, big success. Well, now it's like 3 days later, we got to turn around and we got to go play West Ham. And the fear is that the players have been working for this all season long, and they get to that elation and that they never really get back to that level. And ultimately, that's what happened.
So I'm going to read an excerpt from what I wrote after the League Cup final, which I titled, This is the One, after, you know, of course, the song by the Stone Roses that plays. So this is from the end of the article. This team is driven and unified, guided by a manager who is focused on building and restoring. A manager who just under a year ago inherited a squad that many deemed to be broken and now has them going toe-to-toe with some of the best in the game. Which, you know, a week later felt, you know, that didn't age very well. A manager who has won over both of the data heads and the vibes guys. A manager who radiates intelligence and confidence at a club that rarely gets to experience both over the last 10 years. They value more than just trophies. They value the culture, the purpose, and the approach that can deliver and will deliver trophies. What comes next is still unknown. Nothing is written, and it could all blow up spectacularly again a week later. Goodness knows it's happened before and will happen again someday, but this feeling and this team are all indicating otherwise at this moment, and that is why fans can't help but think that this is the start of something special.
Yeah, and there were a lot of articles like that written. They all said there have been previous false dawns, but this one feels different. And I was just like, well, every article written at the previous false dawns all said the same thing. That's why it was a false dawn. But yeah, you pointed it out, is that you say all that, and then a week later, they go to Anfield and get demolished in a game where everyone and their mother accuses the players of giving up in that game, which really throws all the mentality things into question.
That's
all it was.
One of the things, just like rereading what I wrote after the League Cup final, is part of the reason that I felt that way is because I was comparing it to a year before when, you know, when things are that bad, everyone will say the most like brainless, awful shit about anyone who they could point their finger at. And then when things go bad again, that immediately starts to happen. And that Liverpool game was atrocious for so many reasons, but really, we should be thankful that that was like not setting the tone for, you know, more results that could come. Really, the Sevilla one was awful as well, but that United didn't totally collapse. And like, you know, Mark Kastner came on our podcast and predicted that Liverpool would come back and take over the top four spot from Manchester United after that game. And it almost happened.
Yeah. I mean, this is the part where when we broke down the sections of this, we have part six and part seven as separate but also together, because there is a lot of overriding themes in both, in that, you know, Liverpool up to the FA Cup semifinal when they were crashing out of Europe, Tottenham through the end of the season when they're crawling to the finish line, and throughout both it's sort of, oh right, our flaws. And it's not just Casemiro. He got suspended again after Liverpool, right? Or he was suspended. He was suspended.
The Premier League match after Liverpool
is when he got Southampton and he got the red card.
Yes.
But I actually think they won most of those games where he was gone.
I'll scroll down on the schedule.
They beat Fulham, lost to Newcastle, beat Brentford, beat Everton.
Right.
So they won 3, lost 2. But that's where it was like, oh, our flaws and are coming out. And it wasn't just that. It did feel like they paced themselves to culminate and peak at the League Cup final. And that afterwards it was like sort of like the epilogue. And it was like, we got to keep doing this and we got to keep going. But they were out of gas. And they were in that great run in January when they were playing all those bad teams at home in the cups and everybody went, now's the time to rotate the squad. The only rotation Ten Hag really ever did was he'd bring Harry Maguire in for some games. He would bring Tyrell Malacia in for some games and he'd bring Alejandro Garnacho in for some games and no one else was rotated. Casemiro was playing every day. Christian Eriksen was playing up until he got hurt. And it was just like, you've got guys on the bench here that should be playing and they're not. And this is going to wear out your legs and it's going to come back to bite you. And once it becomes a thing, it's too late to fix it. And now it's starting to be, and like, it's not going to be a thing right now. Starting these guys in the second leg against Nottingham Forest with a 3-0 lead is not going to hurt you in your next game or a week later, but it will hurt you in 2 months. And this is when it starts to happen is they go to Newcastle and again, they're badly exposed as not being able to play against the top teams away from home. And they then come home. They are able to beat Real Betis and they dominate them at home. And then again, no rotation for that second leg when you have a 4-1 lead. And it was just like, we're really running on fumes here. You're able to beat Fulham. Then they lose to Fulham in the FA Cup. They lose to Newcastle. Then they get a win over Brentford, but you're at that point of the season where Brentford, that match is in April. Brentford had no interest in playing that game. And they like squeaked by. It was like a very odd performance from Brentford, who literally just like sat in their own box the entire game, basically handed it to United. And then Everton sort of went, hey, you guys are good at counterattacking. We're going to leave a lot of space in behind and we're going to give Bruno all the time and space to just pick out passes to Antony and Rashford running in behind here.
Well, and even before those 2 points. I feel like the alarm bells were starting to go off again as we were, you know, heading into that last part of the season stretch. Like, United really weren't in that game against Newcastle either when Newcastle won 2-0 at St. James's Park. And that was like one of those, everyone was starting to put, you know, it, like that was supposed to be, and, you know, hindsight now wasn't quite the case for Newcastle either, but that was like Newcastle putting their line in the sand saying like, we're going to be the third best team in England as we prepare to hit a summer that everyone's anticipating is going to be huge for us. And it was just like, but then obviously things changed up a little bit, but that Newcastle game was frustrating because United really were toothless in it.
And that's, I mean, they felt kind of like that in their wins. And I left.
Right, yeah. The Brentford match and the Brentford match was
the
just
Everton
like
one too. And I mean, I had a note in my phone that just said memorable moments question mark. And I think really from this stretch to the end of the season, there's not a whole lot, which is really unfortunate considering that, you know, they went to an FA Cup final, like they won an FA Cup semifinal and that game had no memorable moments.
Yeah. And then and Everton were the one team that tried to play. And it was like, what are your tactics? Like they just played with a suicidally high line, but also let Bruno have all the time and space that he wanted to just pick out passes. And that one, that game should have been 4-1, 5-1. Like that was a good performance from United. It felt a little, it was aided by Everton being like, we're going to help you perform at your peak by allowing you to do what you do best. And it felt a little disappointing because of the scoreline, but United should have won by a lot more.
Yeah. And then, now we go into...
Then they go and face Sevilla, which was a very interesting match that's probably misremembered by a lot, because everybody... It wasn't so much that United were controlling it and on the doorstep and had the whole thing in their pocket. It was United had a very good 6 minutes where Marcel Sabitzer scored 2 goals. And for 80 to 85 minutes, Sevilla were just doing absolutely nothing. So it wasn't that United were dominating. It was just that Sevilla were doing such little that you didn't have to worry about it. And somehow United like hand them the game, and somehow it's 2-2. So shouldn't have been that close, but it also wasn't as dominant as everybody says it was.
I was fortunate not to watch the Liverpool game. I can't remember what I had going on, but I missed the 7-0. So it was like such a comic scoreline that because I wasn't watching it in the moment, it didn't like affect me in the same way I think it affected a lot of people. This felt like one of the lowest moments of the season that I watched, especially the final, 6 minutes in stoppage when it's 2 own goals, when you're up 2-0, like at that point, it's close up shop. We're out. We're going back to Sevilla with a 2-0 lead. And then you just have two really, really bad instances. And all of a sudden it's 2-2. And then Sevilla used that as a launch point when they got back home, and they absolutely kicked the shit out of United.
It's kind of like that Phil Jones moment last season against Wolves or Watford, one of those.
Wolves.
Yeah, and the Wolves get that goal right at the end, and it's like, it's not Phil Jones's fault, but he was there, And like this own goal that bounces off of Harry Maguire's face, it's like headed onto his face and then goes past David De Gea.
He's in there because Varane and Martinez got hurt.
Yeah, it was like literally everything that could go wrong in that game went wrong in those last 5 minutes, because we lose Martinez for the rest of the season. And that is probably terrible, more impactful than people think of. Yeah, I mean, Martinez was phenomenal this season.
Yeah, and it was one of those, like, hey, blame the guy whose face it came off of and not blame them for getting a cross in, because Christian Eriksen, once again, instead of running and following his man, he just kind of jogged and pointed, which was a theme throughout the season.
He looked busy.
Yeah.
That's important. He looked busy.
And they were also without Rashford. And this probably comes at a long-term detriment, is because they were without Rashford. So then they go home. They follow up the Sevilla game by beating, again, relegation contending Nottingham Forest, and then go to Sevilla and are dreadful. Where again, like, they bad luck finds them early, but they never. It didn't matter if Sevilla scored a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth. Like, United were never scoring one in this match.
Right. Just in terms of like personnel available, fitness, everyone was really, really, really getting tired by this point. And it happened.
I don't know if we've said it yet, but I mean, we're finally in the cadence where it was a game every 3 or 4 days.
Oh, we've been in that.
Yeah.
We've been in that since from January. Before the World Cup.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like it was hitting us personally, like us three, even sooner than that. But like, as we were watching that Sevilla game, and it just obviously the players were exhausted, but I think we were all just like, how can we keep up with the amount of games that we like have to watch? And
there were still
right about.
There's still 10 games left in the season by that.
When we lost that game, I was like, oh, it's nice that I'm not going to have to. That like I just got freed up for another 2 Thursdays and potentially a Wednesday. Like, I don't have to put in time off at work for those matches.
Like, I felt so bad.
Joke was on me.
Like I was screwing over Colin because he'd be like, "Hey, can you live tweet this game?" And I was like, "I can't
again
It's during the work day. Like I work for a soccer team. Like I'm busy with that soccer team.
It's like, all right, Nathan has a job too."
what was most concerning was Casemiro looked tired in this match, and it was like, Casemiro, you haven't been playing twice.
You're not allowed to.
You
be
just
tired.
Had four league games off, and an international break. Why are you tired? And
he's
then
over
they,
30.
And then they go and they play. They come back from that loss in Sevilla to they go straight to London to play a dreadful
one of the worst games of the season.
120 minutes against Brighton, just hideous. Which was a testament to the lack of firepower and how tired they were. But also tactically, Erik ten Hag was like admitting, Brighton, you're the better side here. We're just going to disrupt you for 120 minutes, and that's what they did, and created pretty much nothing substantial the other way. They win on penalties. Rashford was back in this game, right?
Yeah, he was in the shootout. Did he start?
And that's probably a result of the draw against Sevilla. And yeah, he came back at halftime in the loss to Sevilla, and probably a result of the draw against Sevilla, and then the loss to Sevilla was all these and the injuries to Varane and Martinez is Marcus Rashford goes, I need to come back. And he didn't look like Marcus Rashford in some of these games, and he probably wasn't fit yet. They go to Tottenham, they get a 2-0 lead, and then throw that away in the second half, which had been a theme. They just had not been playing well in second halves. And certainly it's, again, a top six team away from home. Can't close it out. Can't get the W. And this is a Tottenham team that were struggling.
Yeah, it was kind of like,
was that Ryan Mason's Tottenham that we drew to?
I think it was still Stanley's Tottenham.
It was Ryan Mason's.
Oh
first
no, it
game.
Was Mason's first game.
Yeah,
new manager bounce.
It felt kind of like the Leeds two, where like the two goals were scored to bring it level, and you're like, oh, they're gonna come back and win this. And then they just didn't do anything. They didn't do anything.
Well, Bruno hit the bar like 30 seconds later. He took that shot at 100 miles an hour that hit the bar, and that was it. Nothing else for the rest of the match.
Yeah, it was like Tottenham didn't get more chances to win it after they scored their two goals either. A really unmemorable 1-0 win over Villa, and then the two 1-0 losses at Brighton on a penalty that came in, what, the 90th plus 6th minute or something like that. And then the 1-0 loss to West Ham on the David De Gea, whatever that was.
I forget which error it was. I just remember it was an error.
It went through his hand.
That's when I was thinking top four might not work.
That's when it got real scary. And then, four wins to end the season to kind of cool things down a little bit before the FA Cup final. But
I think it was even earlier than that, because there's like, I think after the Brighton match, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's nine matches to go. So that's when Nathan and I did the podcast where I was like, Nathan, Liverpool are not going to win 9 in a row.
They won 7 in a row.
Right, the West Ham game where Liverpool actually, I think they were within 1 point.
Something like that.
Yeah. It was
just like
the weekend.
It was like
the weekend of the Bournemouth game. Liverpool were within 1 point, and then we went up. We created that buffer again, and they drew. So if we beat Chelsea, then top four was secured, and then we did.
Right, but this is where I say crawl into the finish line, because they didn't. They did their utmost to throw it away. They benefited.
And then they got their it was like a finals week performance where it was like, okay, I just got to get through.
Well, here's what they benefited from: playing home games against teams with nothing to play for. Like when you look back at their last through this stretch of their last five home games: Brentford, Everton, Villa, Wolves, Fulham. That is a team that you would think would be near the relegation zone. Certainly
don't
not
forget Frank
be in,
Lampard's Chelsea.
Certainly not. Oh, I did forget Frank Lampard's Chelsea. And they belong in there too. Brentford are a team that they're not going to be in the European places, so they're happy to not be relegated. And by the time they faced them in April, that was safe. Then you play Everton, who were in the relegation places. And like I said, they were the one team that really showed up and tried. They just had ridiculously weird tactics. Villa, safe. Wolves, at that point, safe. Fulham, on the last day of the season, safe. Chelsea,
safe.
Second to last game of the season, safe. No Europe, nothing to play. They played all these teams where they had nothing to play for. And it was like, and then I start, like, I've looked into this at other teams, like, and it's like, oh yeah, this makes sense why so often top teams, you know, they hit their stride in January and February and they look unbeatable. And then in March and April, they just start dropping points left and right. And then they finish with a bang in May. And even players who scored a bunch of goals and then kind of dried up as they tire out and they don't score a lot in March. They don't score a lot in April. And then they suddenly score 5 goals in 3 games, or 4 goals in 3 games in their final 3 games. And it's like, oh yeah, cause you're playing a bunch of teams with nothing to play for. And those teams are on the beach. And it's at this point of the season, teams will rally themselves for their home games in front of their own fans, Brighton, West Ham. But when they go away, they're just like, let's get through these 90 minutes. And that helps. And that helped Liverpool in that matter. That helped Liverpool win 7 in a row and almost get it. And it is the saving grace for United here.
Yeah. I wonder if that's like just something that's implanted in Man United brains. Because for Ferguson teams, that was like the blueprint for winning titles is like, you got to hit your stride either at like during the winter period where everything's really congested and then carry that on and then just finish strong. And there were a lot of Ferguson seasons where like there were some key losses around like March, like that 08 season, they lost to Chelsea in kind of like late April, something like that. And the years that they, you know, lost the title on the final day, it was like they were dropping points in May that let the other team back into it. But for the most part, it was like those teams found their strength over the winter break and then they carried it on forward. Nowadays, it's like, oh, Man City and Liverpool are probably going to win 9 out of their last 10 games.
But look at Man City. They've started slow several years in a row now. And then they just hit their stride and then they win. And look, they're a very good team. That's the thing. But like, is there an element that teams make it easier on them because they have hit their safety? They're not going to hit Europe. It's like, to the players, what's the freaking difference between 9th or 10th? Like, the club makes £1 million. Like, those positions are just not worth any money anymore.
You don't get a bonus check for beating Manchester City.
It doesn't matter that, like, if I have to take a trip up to the Etihad, like, yeah, you know, it's not going to be the highlight of our season that when we were locked into 11th place, we beat Manchester City in April. There is that mental element that those teams are checked out, and that helps a team like Manchester City and Liverpool and Arsenal and United, all the good teams, where they could show up and 60% of the job's already done for them. They just have to go out there and like, hey, make sure you kick the ball into the net and see this out. You know, Liverpool dropped points against, well, Liverpool's winning streak came to an end against Aston Villa, which was a team playing for Europe. And they still have something to play for. And then the next week they drop points against Southampton, which is a team playing in front of their own fans for the last time in the Premier League. That's going to be something where the players rally around, because also the players are like, I hope a team notices me and I get to stay in the Premier League.
And also, what a game.
Yeah.
That was like if a preseason friendly actually had goals.
Right. And on the other side, United put out their pretty much their strongest 11 a week before the FA Cup when everybody's run out of gas. And
we had a show Fulham who's boss.
Right. And they they beat a Fulham team going through the motions. And Eric Ten Hag goes, well, I'm not just going to give out debuts to youngsters, like they have to earn it. And it's like, come on, dude. Like, this is why we're in the position that we're in, where it came down to the wire. When if a team needs to win 9 in a row just to make the Champions League, like, you should put them away early, and you didn't.
By the way, Josh Harrop is the only goal scorer in Manchester United's history with a 100% goal to game ratio.
That makes sense. Checks out.
Yeah.
Did he earn that debut, or was Mourinho just giving out charity because he had a Europa League final 3 days later?
Where's the broadcast boys on TikTok going, who?
Josh Harrop.
I mean, ultimately,
one of the greatest Crewe Alexandra players in history.
They finished with 75 points. It's the second best campaign since Sir Alex Ferguson retired.
Yeah.
It is just like their best campaign. There's some discrepancy in the underlying numbers. They finished 6th in expected goal difference, 6th in expected points. Expected points had them at about 66. So, like, the 8.6 overperformance is the highest overperformance that United have had in expected points since the 2017-18 season. In both of their previous two high overperformance seasons, they did not make the Champions League the following season. They did not finish in the top 4. That's got to be a concern for the next season.
All I can think of right now is
Brody just going like, it's Josh Harrop. What if I told you Josh Harrop had that dog in him?
I mean, hey, there's a really good photo selection for them if they do want to make a TikTok. But Polly, in those seasons, was there the kind of like goal underperformance that we saw this year?
No. In one of those seasons, there was goal overperformance. One of those seasons was 2020-21. And the other one was 2017-18, which was the David De Gea season. So it was not. And it's interesting because there was a strong goal underperformance for this season, but yet they overperformed their metrics on a whole. And that's sort of the thing to remember about this season is, like, yes, United need to score more goals, but if United scored more goals this year, it probably doesn't help them in the table, because when United were good, they were good. And they were good enough to win. They need to score more goals because a lot of those wins, 1-0 Southampton, 1-0, a lot of these 1-0 wins, you run the risk of what happened against Crystal Palace happening in those games, where just bad bounce. You want to put those teams away earlier. But when they were bad, they were bad. So,
and you point out, you may have already brought this up, but the difference when playing against a high defensive line versus playing against teams that will, block you. And this just seems like it's a recurring problem regardless of manager for Manchester United.
What do you think the problem is?
I mean, most teams score, like, statistically, I would bet, score less goals against teams that have a defensive block versus teams that are playing with a high defensive line. I would say that that's kind of, like, customary. But the problem is Manchester United are not trying to be, part of the pack. They are trying to be Manchester United, which is a team that challenges Manchester City, Liverpool, Arsenal year in, year out. And to do that, I think that they have too many holes to address in one summer window, where their net spend is probably only going to be somewhere around £90 million.
I was going to say that they struggle against low blocks also. And I looked into it. And so basically, the average line height this year for Premier League teams was 44.68. So very unscientifically, I just went, all right, if that's average, let's drop it a little bit deeper. But I didn't calculate. I just said, let's go 42.1. Let's use that as our cutoff point. And I ran the numbers on it. And 42.1 for teams that played higher than that, or teams that played lower, we would say those would be your deep blocks. And so how many games were lower? Were 17 games. United won 15 of them. And they drew and they lost two. And when teams played a high line, so basically average, a little bit below average and higher, 20 matches, 8 wins, 7 losses, 5 draws. Yeah, I do not have the data on the Crystal Palace draw.
But you would assume that that's one of the...
I don't know what I would assume in that one.
That was the home Crystal Palace game?
No, the away one.
Oh, okay.
I would actually probably assume that it was probably a lower block. A lower line. So...
That's interesting.
Yeah. And really what it tells you, like, when you look at like where United's losses are, it's all the... It's like they're all come against the best pressing teams in the league. And there's your problem, is when United play an organized team that knows how to stop you from building up, they are in trouble. And that's where you gotta... That's where you gotta circle it. So, like, yeah, that's where you gotta circle and see, like, that's where we need to get better. We need to get better at getting the ball from the back to the front when we play against a Brighton and a Newcastle. And you managed to beat the top six, all the top six at home. Granted, Chelsea at that point were 12th. And by the way, as we said, Leicester's second worst first half performance. Chelsea was by far the worst first half performance I've seen, not including the Brentford match, from this team this year. They were atrocious in that match. And then, like, probably the best second half that they've played next to the Leicester match. There's, you know, like, that's the area that you got to circle to be like, that's where we need to improve again. Because United were so, like, when they were bad, they were so bad. And when they were good, they were very good. Adding goals, and I wrote about this a few weeks ago, like, if you look at where their underperformance was, in if you say, all right, fine, where they underperform, let's credit them with the goal, those were games that they already won. And they didn't play that many close games. When they lost, they lost. And they didn't draw a lot of games. And the games that they did draw, they didn't really come close to scoring in, where you could say they underperformed.
I think you can argue... I guess the first game of the season is very different because it was a different manager at the time that it was when you played them later in the season. But like, you testing United against Brighton, which is a team that played without fear. I guess the FA Cup final was, or semifinal was, a little bit more, but like a team that typically plays without fear when they go forward and really will go after you, and they're okay conceding goals because they feel comfortable that they can match you. And it feels like that's kind of like the light version of what United need to test themselves against more. Because we saw when they played against Man City, there was absolutely zero fear, even when United were creating, you know, I'll put that in air quotes, creating chances against them. Because like Brighton in that semifinal, the way that they could move the ball forward was far too easy for
Man even United. Newcastle in the final.
Yeah. Yes.
Bruno Guimarães was on a different playing field than everybody else in that final. It was, and yet Casemiro just went, right, you might have all the control, but I'm not going to let you get in from the final third into the box and from there. And I'm like, and then I'm going to take control of it, but I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to be a wall here, but not throughout the match, not in terms of controlling the midfield. Like, that's an area that United really need to improve it.
And that's the part of the season, too, where the really good teams will know that about each other, that they know that they can trust each other enough to play those really quick balls to each other when there's three players, you know, closing down on them in their own half. And Manchester United, you know, even at points in the season where they were pretty good at moving the ball quickly through midfield because they had to, they need to find that as a strength for this side to really take the next level.
Which is,
you know, why it's concerning that they're not going to be able to do a whole lot of that this summer.
I think there were some times during the late Fergie years where United really used the size of Old Trafford to their advantage. big pitch, spread out, lots of space, run at people. And then they struggled when they went away from home because smaller pitch. Team stayed tight. Team, the West Room. And I think United did a really good job of that this season and had similar struggles away from home. The home and away splits for Marcus Rashford are astonishing. And that's an area where he needs to get better in. He had his phenomenal season, but it all came from home. Like, again, that January run where he was scoring in every game helped that he was at home because he did not perform away from home, away from Old Trafford. You're going to bring up, oh, he scored against Barcelona and he scored against Spurs. And like, yeah, he scored
those are,
in the games.
Those are big pitches too. Like
the big,
Camp Nou is
the big
huge.
Pitches and yeah. The teams that his goal against, I'm pretty sure both of his goals were on counterattacks. You know, this team scored more goals on counterattacks than any of the Solskjaer teams. And those teams were known as quote unquote counterattacking teams. Like that's what Ten Hag relied on and did a lot at home. And Marcus Rashford led the league in scores and goals from direct attacks. You've got to, when you go away from home and those things aren't there, you've got to figure out a way to have more of the ball and turn that into more chances. And there's a balance there because there's only so much you're going to have the ball when Casemiro is your midfielder. He's not a great passer. He's very good at like making the first pass to launch a counterattack, but in settled play, not really that great. So you need to figure out how to help him out there. And that's the challenge for this summer and going forward.
Nathan, what's our XV at right now?
Took a little bit of a hit watching City with the treble, of course. But, I mean, I still think the XV's at a good level. You know, we've talked about this on other pods as the season wrapped up where, you know, we're wondering if we robbed Peter to pay Paul this year, where it was like, all right, cool. We spent a lot of money to, with this team, guarantee that we got a third place finish. How is that going to affect us next year as the transfer budget obviously is going to be smaller this year? I think we're all anticipating outside of, you know, something very seismic happening, which we're still waiting on and will drastically affect the XV. So in that case, I think we're moving in the right direction. I feel like the guys are probably all rowing in the right direction. I think Ten Hag definitely did a good job. And I wrote about this in the middle of the season. Actually, maybe that was technically the first third with the World Cup. But, you know, in January, I wrote an article about how I thought, you know, Ten Hag was doing a good job of showing strength when he needed to as a leader, showing grace when he needed to as a leader. Kind of, I was looking at it from the example of him allowing Sancho to get away from things and get his mind right. And for a certain period of time, it looked like that really worked. And we'll see how things continue to go with Sancho. But like there was that incident where he said, you know, Rashford, you were late to the meeting. You're not going to start this game. And it seemed like that nipped whatever was going to happen in the bud. And Rashford continued to perform really well. And so I think Erik ten Hag at this point in his first season has been successful. He brought the first trophy in 6 years. I think he has earned the respect of, you know, the majority of the same fan base. There's going to be some people who probably don't like him, but you know, whatever. All the pieces are in place, right? In the sense that like structurally, it seems like he's got a good working relationship with the people above him. You know, from the outside looking in, as far as he identified a couple guys that he wanted to get, they were able to make it happen. Post Brentford game. So we'll see. I'm excited to have a, you know, 71 days until the next season. So there's a little bit of time for the guys to hopefully get away, rest up. I guess the one thing that we talked about at the beginning of the season that we didn't really see at all this year, and maybe is a little concerning, is the fact that he didn't really bring anybody up. It was just Garnacho and a little bit of Pulisic. You know, it was like, and we've got a couple other of our younger players who should be supplementing the older guys' minutes who got phased out really quickly. Like, you know, when was the last time you watched Alonga play soccer? You know, and so there's, I'd be very curious to see how the roster turns over. But I'd say just like, again, I feel like we're at a BB plus overall on the season, you know?
Yeah.
So that helps the XV.
He put himself in this great spot of having this great season. And no matter what happens in the summer, everybody will just blame owners if things don't go well. Like, so yeah, as Nathan said, there's a cloud over the transfer budget. As Colin said earlier, the weird thing about Casemiro was that it happened so quickly. It was just all of a sudden we lost to Brentford and quickly got the Casemiro deal done and quickly got the Antony deal done. And it's like, yeah, it's because those deals were already done. United couldn't sign off on them because they were like, we already spent all the budget. And Ten Hag said, we need these players. And United were very clear about this back in September. And this was widely reported, but you know, you have to sell newspapers every day. So you have to, you know, it's better to drum up other things so that people will click. Ten Hag said, they said, like, we'll make these signings, but we're tapping into next year's budget to do that. And he said, do it. So that leaves a question mark over the budget because we did spend a lot of it last year. And of course, but like for Ten Hag, who, if United look at him and go, well, we don't have the money, we don't have, because of financial fair play, we can only spend so much, everybody will just be like, oh, it's the ownership. They didn't back him. And that's the big cloud hanging over the team, which does make you wish that, like, I wish Kaby Mainu got some more minutes this year. You know, he benefited from injuries to Donny van de Beek and a suspension to Bruno Fernandes to play, but he never really, and he didn't put in a foot wrong that it I'm not going to say he went out there and deserved a start, but he deserved, hey, like, Bruno, it's the second leg of this thing, you're coming off after an hour, and like Kaby Mainu deserves a half hour. Maybe he didn't do enough to say I deserve a start and a chance to show you what I can do, but he deserved enough to be like, I can go and take somebody else's minutes just to rest them. And he didn't get that. And
it seems like April and May, right, is usually when we have that one player who maybe racks up between like 250, maybe 360 minutes. And we're looking at like, all right, cool. They got a little bit of seasoning. We'll see them kind of feature a little bit more next year, kind of like Alonga did a couple of years ago. Whereas like this season ended and we're kind of sitting here going like, well, maybe Pulisic is going to potentially feature next year. But I think we have all got a lot of eggs in the Amad Diallo basket at this point, just because of like how exceptionally he performed for Sunderland. But it certainly wasn't with this current first team. So you're like,
yeah. And even with that, you're like, it's in the championship. Maybe that's more of like a, we can get value if we sell this player indicator than it is
he's a player,
part of the team next year.
He's a player that you either have to, he's a difficult one because you spent so much money on him. Whereas if he costs £5 million, it'd be like easy to make decision. But he's a player that you either need to keep him with your team or you need to sell him, because it's very Premier League, like, you can't be like, oh, he needs a loan in the Premier League, because Premier League clubs are not in the business of developing your squad for you. They're in the business of I'm trying to stay up, and I'm and the managers are, I'm going to play the players that are going to give me the best chance to win today. They're going to give me the best chance to stay up. They're going to give me the best chance to make it into Europe or whatever. And occasionally you have a player that's so good at one of the big clubs, but isn't like, he's blocked by a world-class player that you're like, oh yeah, we could take him on loan and he'll play. Or, but if they're not good enough, like, or if they're Premier League managers aren't going to give you, if you need 5 to 8 games to get your feet wet before you can take off, Premier League managers not going to give you that time. They're not, they don't care. They're worried about their job. They're not in the business of developing the player for United. So if he goes to a Premier League club and doesn't get off to a great start, and he's not going to get playing time, in which case, no one's, you're not going to feel confident bringing him back and putting him in your team, and nobody's going to be offering to pay money for him. So I do think he's a worthwhile player that should get into the team next year, because Ten Hag seems hesitant to put Sancho on the right wing, and it seems because he wants a left footer there, and Ahmad is a left footer.
For other reasons, there might be
there's some big clouds over your right wing. There's some big clouds over your right wing, and how the club's going to handle that right now.
Do we put Diallo as a part of a deal to bring in Osimhen? Diallo would be sick going back to Serie A.
I mean, I would
Napoli might be like, okay, 145 plus Diallo
instead of 150.
Yeah,
I would say you sign that striker from Atalanta, whatever, Hojlund, the one that they're saying.
We have Holland
is the next Holland, and I'm like, no, you're just saying that because he's Scandinavian, and
and kind of sounds like Holland,
right? And if he were not bleach white, people would be like, that's really racist. But I think you need to look at it and be like, Rashford, the way that Rashford defends and the way that Ten Hag plays Rashford at striker instead of Weghorst because of Rashford's defending. And that it doesn't exist, and that if you kind of shoehorn Rashford into this left wing role, you're blocking the chance for Garnacho. I think if you go with Hojlund and Rashford up top, unless you want to sign Marcus Thuram on a free, that would be a free transfer.
I think we've all signed off on that one. We like that one.
That would be a free transfer that's worth looking into.
Get his brother too. He's a young midfielder at Nice. Hefren Turam.
Yeah.
By the way, this podcast also is all about 2 hours long now, so we should probably wrap it up.
Yeah, I know. Also, Marcus Rashford needs to iron out his consistency. And I know people are going to hear me say that and be like, what do you mean consistency?
And his contract.
Well, that's another point.
Yeah. There are many things that could happen on next week's episode of Manchester United / the Fergie Fledglings podcast.
But we'll know our fixtures.
That's true. We can do an NFL podcast style thing where we're like, oh yeah, we'll go 32-2.
We are not doing
7.
That. We are not doing that. We don't know. We're not in the Europa League anymore, so we don't know which fixtures will automatically be moved to Sunday. That'll still be a mystery.
This is how we end the pod, Colin, right here. Coming up next time on the Fergie Fledglings podcast, Manchester United and Chelsea still 20 million pounds apart from Mason Mount.
Yeah, that's probably the only
And there are rumors that the takeover could be finalized this week.
Oh, God, help us all.